So today I'd like to jump ahead to the 15th section in the Song of Realizing the Way, or the Song of Enlightenment, Shodoka. So I'm going to read from the Brose and Foster translation in entirety for this section. It goes like this. Sravatka and Pratyekas are rigorous, but lack the mind of Tao. Outsiders are intelligent, but lack prajna. Likewise, for the simple and foolish, the young and naive, an empty fist or upraised finger leads to suppositions. Taking a finger for the moon, they squander their energy. Within the pattern of perceiver and perceived, they conjure strong notions. Not seeing a single thing, that's the Tathagata. Only that can be called seeing freely. With understanding, karmic obstructions are empty from the start. Without understanding, one's karmic debt still must be repaid. The starving attend a royal banquet but can't eat. The sick meet the king of doctors. Why don't they recover? Those who practice chan in the world of desire have the power of discernment. They are lotuses blooming, unharmed, in the midst of fire. So Sravaka and Pratyeka students are from the southern sect of Buddhism, which the northerners, the Mahayanas, called Hinayana, or the lesser sect, the lesser vehicle. Pratyeka students were those who were enlightened on their own and only for their own benefit. Sravaka students were enlightened by hearing a Buddha preach, but again, this waking up was for their benefit alone. The later Indian and Chinese sutras written by Mahayana devotees often deride the Hinayana practitioners for being literal and concrete, for being hierarchical and too focused on their own salvation. I would say Sravaka and Pratyeka practitioners do not lack aspiration, but their aspiration is narrow and incomplete. They desire to cross over, not realizing that this very place is the lotus land and that this very body is the Buddha. In opposition, the Mahayanas purport that Buddha nature is not some type of changeless entity, but is none other than the eternally rising and perishing reality of the world. The great Mahayana affirmation is that nirvana is samsara, and samsara nirvana. And so, that being the case, we are all in this together, on one raft, moving together, none crossing, until all cross. Musō Sōseki writes about this Mahayana-style crossing in a poem called The Bridge Where the Moon Crosses. It reads like this. It arches like a rainbow, dividing the stream, joining the shores. One line, a road bringing life, crosses the quiet waves. It has carried donkeys across, horses across, but there is more to come. In the middle of the night, the moon is crossing it, pushing a cart. So none cross until all cross. There are not two separate shores, but there is only one raft. And all of us are on that raft together, living, loving, giving birth, and dying. And there is no way to get off the raft. And we cannot ask or make anyone else leave it. We are all in this together. That is the fact of the Tao, the fact of our practice. And it is the essence of the waking up experience. The fact of our lives, no one and nothing left out. Next, Jung Cha says, outsiders, and outsiders are literally those outside the Tao. He says, outsiders are intelligent, but lack prajna. However, once an outsider came to the Buddha and said, I do not ask for the spoken. I do not ask for the unspoken. The Buddha just sat still. The outsider praised him, saying, the world honored one, with his great compassion and mercy, has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. He then made bows and took his leave. Ananda, who had been sitting aside the Buddha and watched all of this going on, asked, what did the outsider realize to make him praise you? The Buddha said, he is like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. Wu Men said when commenting on this story, Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his realization is less than the outsider's. Now tell me, how do they differ, the disciple and the outsider? So Wu Men is asking, how do they differ? He is not asking us to compare and judge. Be attentive to this point. Remember what I said yesterday. Comparisons lock you into a notion of a self that is defended and defensive. It keeps you separate and alone. Competing and beating really only oneself. But when the tension of comparisons, when the tension of separation dissipates, the Buddha can finally know herself as the Buddha. The outsider can know himself all the way to the bottom. And you can know yourself as you truly are. And in that knowing, there is a great joy. And you begin to see that the other has a lovely intellect, and you an ability to empathize. You begin to notice that one has a lovely use of language, and you a straightforwardness, and another has wisdom, and you compassion. The 10,000 things come forth in their various forms and expressions, all unique, distinctive, different. And though it is incumbent upon us to see distinctions, there is no need to compare. I remember once during a question and answer period at the Maui Zendo with Eiken Roshi, someone asked, all practitioners, Buddhist, Jew, Catholic, Muslim, pagan, don't they all get to the same place in the end? Eiken Roshi responded quite definitely, no, they don't come to the same point. They don't come to the same place. Trying a different tack, the questioner said, but don't we all climb the same mountain? Different sides maybe, but the same one? And Eiken Roshi said, we all climb different mountains, and no one arrives at the peak. So different or the same as Wu Men? So Jung Cha next says, within the pattern of perceiver and perceived, they conjure strange notions. Jung Cha is still talking about the Hinayana practitioners and outsiders, saying they're caught in the mental formations that posit subject and object, that throw up real and illusion, seer and seen. But he is also talking about us when we hold on to anything or keep anything at bay. We needn't fear or disregard our feelings or our thoughts or sensations. We don't have to hold to inside or outside or in between. These all are just patterned ways of perceiving and experiencing. Realize each thing. Realize all things are just clouds. Just clouds moving across the vast blue sky of your very own minds. We don't have to get rid of the clouds, but we also needn't make them into dragons and demons and angels or saints. They are simply clouds, sometimes somber and dark, and at other times bright and light. We don't have to compare or contrast. All we need to do is rise when the bell rings, walk in Kinhin, not coming from anywhere, not going anywhere. Just one breath to step, and the next breath to step. Not coming from anywhere, not going anywhere, but arriving again and again, and then coming to our seats and taking our position and our posture, sitting up straight, allowing our hearts to open, our diaphragms to open, our shoulders to drop, and our attention to drop into our bellies, where we then sit at the gate of ease and joy. When we do not see one thing, when we do not see one thing as separate from ourselves, as different than ourselves, that is the Tathagata. You then are the Tathagata, seeing freely. You are the Tathagata, seeing right through the constructs of subject, object, and activity, seeing right through the constructs of perceiver and perceived. And when we do not see one thing, you see right through the assertion of self and the assertion of the idea of no self. When we see through, or to say it the way Jung Cha does, when we do not see a single thing, we then find, not that we do not have karma, but we find that our karma is empty. And there is a great joy in this knowing. There is a great joy in this experience. There is a freedom. We are no longer constrained by our ideas of us and them, by profane and sacred, We are no longer hindered or obstructed as we move freely in the world. We are still engaged, but we do not stick to things, and they do not stick to us. Finally, we can participate fully because there is nothing to hold us back. Of course, this doesn't mean we can do whatever the hell we want. This seeing through, seeing freely, is called Kuan Yin. She is the Bodhisattva sitting on our altar. She sits in royal ease, relaxed but poised, ready to move in a moment's notice to relieve the suffering in the world. And just as an FYI, she is often depicted holding a lotus blossom and a vase containing sweet dew, Amrita, the dew of the unborn and undying. She is the goddess of compassion, fully engaged in the venture of saving all beings with her generosity of heart, with her many hands, and with the tears streaming down her face. Through her, and as her, we realize we are originally endowed with the virtue of giving. With her heart and our heart, with her heart she knows what to do. With her hand she has the tools that are necessary. And with her tears, the tears of joy and care streaming down her face, she is able to fill the beggar's cup, our cup, with the most cooling drink. She is able to fill the beggar's bowl, our bowl, with delicious food. And she's able to fill our bag with gifts for all. Salves and ointments for the sick, pennies for the poor, candies for the kids, and comeuppance for the arrogant and aloof. Yongja next says, those who practice Zen in the world of desire have the power of discernment. They are lotuses blooming, unharmed, in the midst of fire. Lotuses do not grow on mountaintops in austere, arid places. They are a type of water lily that grow in valleys and lake regions. In practice, however, we can say they grow in the mud of our zazen and in the mud of our lives. We do not practice zazen to get away from things. We do not practice to transcend things. We practice zazen to open to the conditions of our lives, to the mud and dirt, and it is there where the lotus blooms. It is in things and through things that we wake up. The world of desire, after all, is our world. And we use desire, which is often thought to be a bad thing in contemporary Western Buddhism. We use desire to help us deepen our practice in our lives. We use desire by desiring to save all beings, by desiring to live from our deepest body, the body of love and understanding. We use desire by desire to dream the deepest dream of all, the dream of the Buddha. William Blake says this about desire in the marriage of heaven and hell. He says, those who restrain desire do so because theirs is weak enough to be restrained. And the restrainer, or reason, usurps its place and governs the unwilling. And being restrained, it by degrees becomes passive, till it is only the shadow of desire. However, when going into desire, we must have a daily Zen practice, which includes training periods and sesshin. We need this practice, this discipline, to give a shape and a form to desire so that it doesn't distract us, but instead allows us to go most deeply into what we are. Lotuses, flowers, opening, shaped and colored by the heat of life and death. Shaped and colored by the heat of relationship and by the heat of being human. Okay, so thank you.